The title of this talk is Being an Ivry in the Age of the Smartphone, Standing Apart from a 24/7 Culture. What I would like to do is first talk about the age of the smartphone, then talk about what it means to be an Ivry, and then talk about being an Ivry in the age of the smartphone. So let's start by talking about the age of the smartphone. If you talk to high school educators, of whom I happen to be one, about the biggest challenges that we face in high school education now, I will tell you that if you say to them, what is the biggest challenge you face right now, they will do this. They will pick up their phone and wave it at you. We feel it in many, many different ways. We feel it in school, in the classroom, when kids are trying to sneak under their desks. The tell is their thumbs. If I see your thumbs wiggling energetically, I know there's something going on down there that I don't want to be going on. We see it in kids leaving class and going to the bathroom, and they're not really going to the bathroom, they're really going to check their phones in the bathroom. We also see it in the kinds of social interactions that happen outside of school, in the social media space, in the online space, but come back into the life of the school because that kind of meanness or bullying or unkindness or whatever comes back to us because we are expected to deal with it as school administrators. A parent will come to us and say, so-and-so posted this picture, sent this thing, did this unpleasantness to my child. That didn't happen in school. That didn't happen in a place where I could potentially see it. That happened on a WhatsApp group that I don't have access to, that I didn't create, but that ultimately I'm being asked to deal with the repercussions of. So that's what it means to live in the age of the smartphone. It means the age of distracted driving. It means the age, as you all know, of parents on the playground, their kids doing whatever, and the parents looking at the screen, right? We've all seen this as we walk down the street, pedestrians crossing the street like this, and I'm trying not to hit them with my car. They don't see anybody coming or going because all they see is their phone. We all know what it means to live in the age of the smartphone. But here's the thing that I am not here for, as the children say. I am not here for, wah, 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 kids these days with their Snapgram and their InstaChat, and this is so terrible. This is a new technology. It is a new piece of technology that is transforming the world that we live in. We all live with it. We are going to continue living with it. And explaining to our children why things were better when we were 17 is not a viable strategy for addressing the world that we are all living in. I say all the time, this is specifically the impact of technology on education. This is not me surmising this. We have this in the history books. Before the invention of the printing press, books used to be copied by hand. That's what they did, right? People sat and copied text by hand. And that was a great educational tool, because by the time you were done copying a text by hand, you knew a whole heck of a lot of what the text said. And when the printing press was invented, you had people, including in the Jewish world, who said, this is terrible. It's going to make the kids lazy. If they all had printed books and they don't have to copy them themselves, no one's going to work and no one's going to learn anything. And wah, 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 kids these days with their printing presses and their books. Guess what? I am sure that the invention of the printing press was a very disruptive technology. A whole bunch of monks who were employed in scriptoria, copying over scrolls, were out of work. Educational paradigms that were based on learning by heart had to change. Learning by heart from scarce text had to change when people could read from plentiful text. And then eventually people adjusted to the change, and we get an explosion of what the early modern historians call print culture, and all kinds of new books being written, and all kinds of new svarim being written, because you can, right? And so, yes, it takes a while to adjust, and it's really unsettling while you go through it, and it puts a lot of people at unease because it changes the world they grew up in and what they're comfortable with, and it ends up opening whole new avenues for learning and thinking and understanding. So I don't have any use for, you know, it was so much better when I was a kid. First of all, because we're not going back, so we might as well figure out how to deal with where we are now. And second of all, because there are great benefits. There are great benefits to these new technologies. Kids have access to a great deal of information very easily. It does mean that how we think about school has to change. School is no longer going to be about, I have information and you do not. I will tell it to you. You write it in your notes. You tell it back to me on a test. You can access the information very easily. So now, what does teaching you mean? What are you learning? There are actually much more valuable things you could be doing with your time than writing down the chronology of what happened and then what happened next and what happened after that. Right? You can be learning how to think and learning how to interpret information and learning how to process things and make meaning out of them rather than just take in factual information and assimilate it. It's a little bit unnerving for a generation of teachers who were educated in the old model and maybe used to teaching the old model to think about what it means to teach in the new model. But it actually opens up enormous new opportunities. About a decade ago, the Atlantic Monthly ran a cover story called "Is Google Making Us Stupid?" I had no patience for stuff like that. No, Google is not making us stupid. Google is giving us access to enormous amounts of human knowledge very easily. That might be unsettling. That might change how we do things. That might make us think differently about a lot of things. We are not stupider because I can look it up while I'm walking around than when I used to have to pull an encyclopedia off the shelf. You try to explain to kids today what an encyclopedia is, right? They do not understand what you are talking about. This big book. What did you use it for? Well, when I had to write a report, why didn't you just Google it? Because Google didn't exist. So what did you do on your computer? I didn't have a computer. You know, it's like... So that's the first thing to say. The age of the smartphone offers us enormous opportunities. I will go on to say that even the age of social media, which is not just the age of smartphone and having information at our fingertips, the age of social media offers us enormous opportunities. Lowering the barriers to publication, which means that people who couldn't have started a print publication because of costs, because of whatever it is, can easily share thoughts, ideas. I have so many examples, every one of which would be a distraction. But so much wonderful and interesting learning and knowledge that I have accessed either by finding it online or that was wholly produced online, right? There are now Torah magazines and magazines of Jewish interest that are wholly produced online, right? There are outfits like YU Torah that disseminate thousands of shiurim online to anybody who wants to access them and find them. But I think I was going to talk about the values of social media. So let's go back to that for a second. Making it possible to hear voices that might not have access to platforms and might not have been able to be heard is enormously valuable. I will give you one specific example relevant to the audience that we are in. For reasons that have to do with market dominance and numbers and a lot of other things that we're not going to go into, the general market trend in publications produced for the Orthodox world has been over the past few decades to stop showing pictures of women, teenage girls, and even girls above the age of 6. Okay? The internet has created a space in which women can mobilize, make their voices heard, and start to organize to push back. I'm sure some of you have seen various efforts along these lines from womenhavefaces.com, Facebook groups, other kinds of mobilizing or organizing groups, where once each one of us would have been sitting in our living rooms going, I can't stand when they print those pictures of Shabbos tables and there's no mother and there's no grandmother and there's no sisters. That's messed up. Now there's actually a place to mobilize and have our voices be heard. Or when somebody in the community says, hi, gay people in the Orthodox community is a real thing and we need to think about it and stop pretending we don't exist. Or, hi, the pain of, fill in, right? Parents dealing with children with disabilities, single adults who have yet to meet their life partner, couples trying very hard to conceive children having a difficult time of it. The internet, social media, Facebook has created a space for people to be able to share their experiences and for others of us who might not have had one or all of those experiences to say, by hearing your voice, I can learn something important that I need to know. I'll tell you more broadly as an American, I have found social media very useful for me as an American in giving me access to other voices I might not have heard, and I want to tell you one very specific example. A number of years ago, an African-American woman named Sandra Bland was moving from her home wherever to Texas to take a new job. While driving down to Texas on her way to take her new job, Sandra Bland was pulled over by a police officer supposedly for some driving or traffic violation. The conversation between them got heated. Sandra Bland was arrested and jailed. 3 days later, she was found dead in her jail cell. Her death was ruled a suicide. All over Twitter, African Americans started tweeting with the hashtag, hashtag, if I die in police custody. And they were all saying the same thing. If I die in police custody, know that it wasn't a suicide, I was killed. And if they make up a story, they're making up a story, but I was killed. So this was striking to me to read, because it never crossed my mind. If you made up a list of the 100 things I'm most worried about, or the 1,000 things I'm most worried about, or the 10,000 things I'm most worried about, being arrested and then killed while in detention would not cross my mind. It's not there. It's not on the list. The fact that there are Americans for whom this is something that they think about or worry about itself was very powerful for me to see. There's a PS to this story. About a week ago, video that was taken on the police officer's body camera during the arrest was finally released, during the arrest of Sandra Bland. And it was released because of a lawsuit filed against the police department. The police department had tried to suppress that video footage. And the video footage showed, not surprisingly to like any African American or probably pretty much anyone who's paying attention to this, that the police officer had been wildly and inappropriately aggressive with Sandra Bland, threatening her from the first minute he pulled her over, that his account of the interaction, which was that he felt threatened by her and she was getting aggressive, was a lie. Kind of changes how you think about that interaction that ended up with her in jail and then ended up with her dead. Okay? It was very powerful for me to hear the voices of Americans that I would not have otherwise heard in that moment, to understand how they experienced or saw that, and as it happens in this particular case, later evidence, by which I mean years later, bore out that they had reason to be suspicious about the official story they were given. So that's why I don't have a lot of use for Google making us stupid, and kids these days, and it was so much better when, okay, we grew up in the world we grew up in, it was the way it was. They grew up in the world they're growing up in, it is the way it is. So if we're going to be effective at parenting or grandparenting or educating, it's going to be to figure out how to engage with the kids where they are, not to tell them why it was better where we were. So that's the age of the smartphone. It's worth saying, though, that the age of the smartphone is not all advantages and wonderfulness, and that has to be acknowledged, too. Not just the distracted driving and the absorbed in your device, whether you're the parent or the kid. The last couple of years have given us reason to see that same lowering the threshold to publication, making it easier for groups to have their voices heard, that people who were once marginalized can now be heard, doesn't just allow people within our own community or people within our broader American community who maybe haven't had power and haven't had access to the microphone to get access to the microphone, it has also allowed people who rightfully were denied any place in respectable society to come on out and find their friends. So all of a sudden, you have neo-Nazis crawling out from under rocks, finding each other online, right? Hooking up online, forming these groups, getting radicalized, radicalizing other people in a way that they were not able to. I am not suggesting that everything in this age of the smartphone is all sweetness and light. I am saying it is the world we live in, and we have to figure out how to deal with it. And saying things were better when we were kids is not a way of dealing with it. So I don't mean to suggest it's all sweetness and light. I certainly don't accept that it's making us all stupid, or kids today don't know how to talk to each other, or they don't know how to socialize. Hi, I work with teenagers every day. They know how to socialize. They don't know how to socialize. They only know how to look at their screens. They don't know how to talk to other people. No, they can't. None of this is true. It's just not true. It's not true. Empirically, it's not true. It does have its challenges. All that is true. It's going to need to be dealt with. But it is the world we live in, and we have to deal with it, not hand-wring and lament why it can't be different than it is. So that's the age of the smartphone. Now let's talk about being an Ivri. Avraham Avinu is given this title, Avraham HaIvri, which means Abraham from the other side. So literally means like the guy from the other side of the river. He's like that dude from Queens, right? Avraham from the other side of the river. But of course, Rashi, quoting Chazal, says the whole world stood on one side and Avraham stood on the other side. Being an Ivri meant in certain ways standing apart from the prevailing culture, from the prevailing norms, from the prevailing practices of the day. Everybody else was engaged in some polytheistic pagan worship, and Avraham shows up with this radical idea that there is only one God whom you cannot see, right? This transcendent lone deity that has all the powers and all the abilities and you can't see him, and also you're supposed to conduct yourself according to certain ethical standards. Right, Hashem says about Avraham Avinu that I know him, that he will command his children and his household after him, la'asot tzedakah u'mishpat. that they will act with righteousness and justice. So that's what Avraham Avinu brings to the world. He's Avraham HaEvri, standing apart from the rest of the world. But here's the thing. How does Avraham Avinu spend his time? Does he spend his time on a mountaintop, sitting there with his legs crossed, meditating about the unity of the Creator? No. What did we all learn in kindergarten, or at least our kids or our grandkids all learned in kindergarten? He had a tent with doors on four sides, right? So passers-by from any direction could come in and hear the message that he was teaching. Yes? So he's an Ivri. He's apart from the prevailing cultural norms, and yet he's doing it by sitting right in the middle of the world, engaging with everybody who's coming from any direction. My principal, Rabbi Tilly Hartstark, once when he was speaking to a grade at SAR High School, talked about this, and he said, sometimes when you want someone to help you fix a problem, the best kind of a person to do it is the insider-outsider. An insider-insider is in the problem with you. Someone who's part of my school is part of the problem. An outsider-outsider who doesn't know the culture of an Orthodox Jewish high school, doesn't know our community, doesn't know our issues, can't show up and start talking to me about whatever the problem is because they don't know which end is up and they can't be helpful. But an insider-outsider, somebody who knows the community, knows its norms, knows the way it functions, understands, but is not directly part of this particular issue, has the perspective to be helpful, to guide, to shape, to change. Rabbi Hartstark said that's what Avraham HaEvri is, not sitting on a mountaintop meditating. He's the insider-outsider. He's in that world, but he's also the Ivri standing apart from the world. I then later heard Rabbi Jonathan Sacks speak about this, and talking about the same phenomenon, he called it being in the world, not of the world. The same idea. It is not the ideal of separating from the broader world around us. That world is treif, I want nothing to do with it. That is not a position that enables you to shape, have an influence on, contribute to the world in which we live. It is the idea of sitting in your tent open on four sides and yet being the Ivri distinct from that culture. Being in the world and not of the world. There is a community whose response to the challenges posed by the age of the smartphone is to say, don't have them, right? Don't have access to Wi-Fi. Don't have access to the internet. It's so problematic. It raises so many issues. It raises so many challenges, so let's just make sure that we cut off from it completely. That, in our community, is not our approach. But here's the thing. All too often, when we get done rejecting that approach, we don't come up with another one. We just say, oh, that's crazy, not to have internet, not to have smartphones. I don't know how you live that way in the 21st century. And then what we're left with is a community in which kids increasingly are getting smartphones, not in 8th grade, not in 7th grade, if we're lucky in 6th grade, and sometimes in 5th grade. So a bunch of years ago, some of you may remember, there was a very big gathering at Citi Field, but some of us are just going to keep calling Shea Stadium until the day we die, because we just are, but officially it's called Citi Field now. And there was a very big gathering within the Haredi world to raise awareness of the challenges and threats posed by technology. My students, I was in SAR High School, my modern Orthodox students thought that this whole gathering of people to identify the threats posed by technology and to kind of swear it off, to commit not to having smartphones or whatever the particular commitments they were asked to make, my students thought that was nuts. They thought it was the craziest thing they had ever heard. I didn't think it was so crazy, actually. First of all, I grew up in that world. Most of my family's in that world. I had brothers-in-law who were at the SCFA, so I think that gives you some perspective, maybe also. But also, I know the other side of it. The other side of it is that when I was starting a program in SAR to try to tackle some of these issues, we said, okay, let's make a program for parents in the high school. Then we said, we can't make a program for parents in the high school to tackle issues that come up with kids having access to these devices because they all already have the devices by the time they start high school. So then we said middle school, 6th to 8th grade. And then I was told, oh, you really can't start in middle school because there was just this issue that came up with 5th graders and their smartphones. You have to start with 4th grade parents and up if you want to tackle the issue of smartphones. And then I happened to go, YU, the Center for the Jewish Future, organizes a great program every year, a conference for Rebbetzins, a Yarchei Kallah for Rebbetzins, that I've been going to for the last many years. So I was at the Rebbetzins conference. I took advantage of being there to ask a number of the other Rebbetzins, do these kinds of issues come up in your community? What age do they start? And a couple of different Rebbetzins from a couple of different suburban communities were saying to me, sixth grade, fifth grade, sometimes fourth grade. So I said to my students, it's great that you think that approach, the approach of let's gather by the tens of thousands to say we're not going to have this and we're not going to use this and we're not going to engage with it. It's great that you think that's not your approach. It's not my approach either. But then what's your approach? You can't not have an approach. The alternative to that cannot be, you'll pardon me, that fifth graders are looking at pornography on their cell phones on the back of the school bus because some parent handed a 10-year-old the entire world with unfiltered access to everything the world produces in the palm of their hands and said, go. That can't be the alternative. So, what then does it mean to be an Ivri in the age of the smartphone? To be in the world, but not of the world. To be an insider, outsider. If I assume that within our broader centrist Orthodox, modern Orthodox community, we are not, in fact, giving up on access to the internet, giving up on all of these technologies, that is not the approach that we choose to take, then how are we approaching and dealing with these issues? First thing I want to say, we will now come to some practical suggestions. We need to get our heads out of the sand and face the realities of the issues that we are facing. A story. In Asara High School, we run a program for 10th grade parents. We teach a combined Beit Midrash and health class in 10th grade, talking to the students about sexuality, the Torah perspective on sexuality, and then a health class. We do an evening for the parents in which we say to the parents, here is what we are talking to your children about, but it is essential that you talk to your children about these issues. They should not just be hearing our perspectives and values, they must be hearing your perspectives and values. We explicitly say to parents, in a world in which just about all of our students, if not all of our students, have smartphones, in a world of unlimited access to everything, you must talk to your children around your values about explicit depictions of sexuality, about pornography, about all of these kinds of things. You have to talk to your kids about it. We ran this program a couple of years ago. Independently, two different mothers of 10th grade boys came over to me separately to say the same thing. I don't want to talk to my son about pornography, each of them said, because I don't want to give him any ideas. Honey, you gave him a smartphone with unlimited access to everything out there and no parental controls when he was 11 years old. You don't have to give him ideas. He has ideas. Now you have to talk to him and transmit your values and tell him what you care about and what you think. I mean, probably should have done it 4 years ago when you gave him the smartphone, but if you didn't, like, let's at least start now. So let's get our heads out of the sand and get our heads out of denial. About 2 weeks ago, there was a letter to the editor in the Wall Street Journal written by a mental health professional who is also the head of an organization called Wait Until 8th. This is not a from guy. He's not coming from a Torah perspective. He's coming from a mental health perspective, and his obvious agenda, the title of his organization, is don't give kids smartphones until they're in 8th grade. In 8th grade. Wait till they're 13. Which doesn't sound like so much waiting, but it's a darn sight better than 11 or 10, so we'll take it. I used to say, and by used to say, I mean when I started talking about this a whole 2 years ago, based on data that I saw a whole 2 years ago, that the average age at which the American child first sees pornography is 11. That, of course, coincides with the average age the American child first gets a device like this is 11. Dr. Wait Until 8th, in his letter to the Wall Street Journal a couple of weeks ago, and I have not checked his data, so I cannot tell you that I have verified this personally. I just saw it a couple of weeks ago. I haven't had time to check it up, but I'm telling you that I saw it. Now says that the average age of American children's first access to pornography is 8. Is 8. even if that's not precisely accurate, even if it's, oh wow, 11, right? We cannot be naive about this because naive is dangerous, okay? We need to acknowledge what the reality is so we can address and deal with it. Sometimes I get parents who say to me, I'm my daughter's best friend. She tells me everything. No, you aren't. No, she doesn't. I want to tell you that I find those cases particularly dangerous because I think when parents think their kids tell them everything, they don't know what they don't know. When you know you're a parent and your kid's a teenager and your kid's going to try not to tell you stuff, then at least you could be realistic. If you think your kid is confiding in you about everything, I mean, I'm going to tell you 100% of the time, not 98% of the time, 100% of the time when a parent says this to me, I know we have like a little bit of la-la land going on. No, no teenager in the history of the human race has ever told their parents everything. It wasn't true when you were a teenager. It wasn't true when I was a teenager. It's not true now that my three teenagers are teenagers. It just does that. Doesn't happen. Sorry. Okay? So that's the first thing I want to say, is that we need to be honest and realistic about what the issues are. The next thing I have to say is, the grown-ups have to be prepared to be the grown-ups. You're actually not your daughter's best friend. You're not your student's best friend. You're not the cool mom or the cool grandmom who gets your kid the device because they ask for it and all their friends want it without really thinking through the implications and the ramifications. None of those is a good place to be. The job of the grown-ups is to be the grown-ups. And that does not mean, we'll soon talk about what that means. That does not mean fighting with your kids, and it does not mean being unreasonable, and it does not mean not appreciating they live in the world they live in. But it also means that being the cool mom, or being their friend, or being the, we sometimes encounter a phenomenon in the schools in which the parents don't want to fight the fight with their kids, and so they ask us to. You should make a rule that A, B, C. Because if I, the school, fight the fight, you know, then you, the parent, don't have to. I get that. We could try to make some rules. But you are the parent, and when you're, I have a second grader who asks me for a smartphone all the time. I'm like, ha, 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 child, nope. Come back to me in 10 years. We'll talk about it. I have two kids in high school who don't have smartphones. I have one kid in college who got a smartphone when he started college. So I will just say, now it's true. Everything's true. Every kid is different. Every situation is different. I'm not advocating here a blanket set of universal principles. If you had a child for whom, whatever reason, you thought this was very important or it was going to be very painful or it was going to be a very big issue, you might make the decision differently. But the just, I don't know, everyone seems to be getting them a sixth grade argument. Or, well, she's going on the bus, she needs a way to reach me. Yeah, I don't know. Lots of people went on buses, lots of people still go on buses without smartphones, and, you know, the world's not come to an end. So the first thing we have to do is to face the situation realistically. The second thing we have to do is be prepared to be the parents. That doesn't mean being the meanies. It does mean being willing to stand apart and say, here's what I think is good or right, reasonable or appropriate, consistent with our religious values and with our other values, and not just, well, I guess if every other kid in sixth grade, or I don't want to have a fight, or my kid in high school said. But here's what I want to say is the third point. It is not enough for us to decide to play the grown-ups as the grown-ups. We have to walk the walk. I will tell you that when I talk to teenagers about distracted driving, about texting while driving, they tell me all the time, my parents are worse than I am. You know who you should talk to? That other mother who drives carpool and is texting while she's driving carpool, and I don't feel comfortable saying anything to her because she's not my mother, but she's texting while she's driving carpool. Right? We can't tell our kids dinner is a device-free time. It's family time. Oh, but my work is so important, I have to be on my device. So I have to see if anybody from work emailed me. I have to be on my device. If you are a transplant surgeon waiting for someone to tell you that the heart has arrived so you can transplant it into someone, you have to be on your device. There are very few other jobs where if you say, I'm taking off an hour every night from 6 to 7 or 7 to 8 or whatever the time is, I'm having dinner and being with my kids and I'm not picking up my phone, that the world is going to come to an end. For many of us, it is a choice to be electronically tethered that way. We choose it because we feel important. We choose it because we want to look good to our bosses. We choose it because we like to be the one who answers the email first. I win. All of that is a choice, and it's modeling to our kids and to our families what we think is right. You go out with your friends, and people cannot leave their phone on the table for 45 seconds without checking it. What does it say to you about your importance in their life versus the importance of anybody who might be on the other side of that device in their life? We have to model it. We have to walk the walk. If we can't put down our phones for long enough to cross the street, drive the car, take the kids to the park, sit at the dinner table, then we can't talk to our kids about it. I'll give you another very specific example. My oldest, the one who's now in college and finally has a smartphone, the first device he got was an iPod, which, you know, all the recent generations of iPods have screens and are internet devices. And so when he got it, when he was in middle school, I said to him, I'll get you the iPod, but I'm going to take it back and lock it up for Shabbos. And he said to me, you don't trust me? And I said, I trust you loads. I'm just taking back the iPod and locking it up for Shabbos. And I told this story at work in the teacher's room at SAR, and one of my colleagues, I don't remember who, or I would credit them, I don't remember who, said to me, you handled that wrong. You shouldn't have said, I'm locking up your device for Shabbos. You should have said, we lock up our devices for Shabbos. That we as a family, as part of our commitment to what Shabbos looks like and how we do Shabbos, all of our devices get parked someplace for Shabbos. They're not out and about and accessible over Shabbos. I said to my colleague, that's such a great idea. That's such a great way of saying that this is not something I impose on you. This is a commitment that we all make. So in my house now, we have like a table in the second apartment where we park all devices for Shabbos. Right before Shabbos, some kid runs around rounding up all devices and plopping them there. And that's like the parking lot where all devices go to sit over Shabbos. And my colleague was exactly right. That's a powerful statement about a shared set of values rather than I, the parent, am imposing. I told you about this evening that we did at SAR for parents, the one that we had to start in fourth grade because high school was too late and middle school was too late. And we showed them a video that was made, again, not for the from world, but for the broader American world about devices and the impact of devices. It's called Screenagers. That's the name of the movie. So we showed them Screenagers, like teenagers who are growing up on the screen, Screenagers. And one of the things that they say in that movie about negotiating a contract with your kids before they get a device is also that the contract has to go two ways. Parents also have to agree to be bound by terms. They might not be the same terms. You might say, the child has to turn in their device at 9 o'clock, and obviously the grown-up doesn't, or whatever it is. But there will also be some things like dinner time is a no-screen time that should bind all family members, or that driving is an absolutely no-screen time that should bind all family members. So it's not just what I'm imposing on you, but it's a we are all in this together. I will say that it's worth thinking about the question about whether that means that access controls or filters on the internet shouldn't be on the kids' specific devices, but should be on the internet that comes into the house. If we believe that there are certain things that are not appropriate for committed Jews, and that honestly have all kinds of other, right? We could have a whole conversation now about gender ideas and pornography and feminism and men and women and masculinity and femininity and body images. There are a lot of reasons to find that problematic, aside from the halachic reasons to find that problematic. But if we think that there are certain things that are not appropriate, and they're not appropriate for anyone, then is the right message to send to our kids, I'm limiting your access, or is the right message to send that we collectively are deciding that this is something that shouldn't be able to come into our house? Obviously, you have to set your controls appropriately. They have to make sense for you. So when I got my son, finally got my son his smartphone, I put on parental controls. My son's 18. I put parental controls on his phone. My son is 18 years old. He got his first smartphone. And I put parental controls on his phone. And then one day we were in Teaneck, and he wanted to order from Chickie's, you know, the fried chicken place in Teaneck. And I said, download the Chickie's menu, call them, have it ready, and we'll pick it up. And he said to me, I can't download the Chickie's menu. It's blocked by parental controls. So that took me a little while to figure out. I think it's probably the chicken breast on the Chickie's menu that's triggering the parental control. So if you're going to set parental controls for the whole house or the whole Wi-Fi network, content controls, you probably want to make sure that you calibrate them appropriately so you can still access the Chickie's menu. I will say that. But nevertheless, I think thinking about what walking the walk looks like for the parent as well as the kids is important. I'll tell you one more thing. This is not directly connected to parental walking the walk, but is one thing I found. Actually, students of mine, family of students of mine, whose mother is actually a well-known expert on women's sexual dysfunction in the Orthodox Jewish community, one of those students once told me that in her house, the rule was that screens didn't go into the bedrooms, that screens stayed in public places. And we thought that was a great idea. And so in our house, that's the rule about screens, that they have to stay in public places. There are a lot of devices in my house. There aren't not devices. We have lots of devices. We have computers, and we have iPads, and one of my kids now has a smartphone. We have lots of devices. But we do have a rule in my house that screens have to be in public and open areas, not in private areas in your room with the door locked. Some parents have rules about, you know, at what time of night the phone gets turned off, or it gets charged, or it gets parked in the kitchen. It doesn't stay in your room overnight. And other kids say, well, I use my phone as my alarm clock, so that won't work for me. There isn't a single set of rules that I'm going to hand out that's going to be, this is the way you navigate it for everybody in all times and places. As with pretty much anything else about confronting the challenges of the contemporary world, it requires balance, it requires calibration, it requires rethinking. Did I do it right? I didn't get it right. Maybe I need to adjust. What worked about that? What didn't work? It requires being responsive and hearing what our kids or our teenagers are telling us and figuring out if what we said makes sense or doesn't really apply anymore or needs to be reconsidered. It's simpler to just say no, right? It's simpler to say you can't, ever, under any circumstances, no. But it's not the mission or the charge that we as a community think that we have. The mission or a charge that we as a community think that we have is that mission, is that charge of Avraham HaIvri as the insider-outsider, as in the world but not of the world, that we are engaging with the broader world. We are engaging with what it has to offer. We are contributing to shaping it with an awareness of the challenges that poses. We're not being naive about the extent to which that can pose challenges. And we are trying to both engage with the world but stand apart from the world, shape it and use it without being overwhelmed or swamped by it. That is, I think, what is the mission, the strength, the beauty of this particular way of living out Torah Judaism. This manifestation of it right now is a really great challenge for us as a community. It needs attention. It needs work. It needs mindfulness. Not just like, sort of, I don't know, everyone else is doing it, so I guess we'll do it that way. How am I interacting with my technology? How are my students, how are my kids, how are my grandkids interacting with their technology? What role am I playing with this? Is that the right role? So it requires mindfulness and attention and thoughtfulness, not just, I don't know, I sort of kind of everyone else seems to be, so I guess we will. But it is yet another arena where there is enormous opportunity for benefit, and there is enormous opportunity for contribution, and our charge and our mission is to figure out how to benefit and how to contribute while engaging in ways that are consistent with our values, with our mission as the descendants of Avraham Avinu. Thank you. We'll now take a couple of minutes worth of questions, yes. Or you can go outside and get coffee if you'd like. Okay, so I'll comment first about Shabbos and then about conversational skills or lack thereof. I personally, we will not go there, but American politics for the last couple of years has been an enormous drain of emotional energy on my part, and having a 25-hour mandated being away from it every week has been like enormously restorative. I don't even know how people function who are just being bombarded with this all the time, constantly, never stopping. I don't think I ever appreciated Shabbos that way because I never felt the need to really be apart from something. And in the past couple of years where I feel it very strongly, I appreciate Shabbos that way enormously. The kind of mandated, because everyone can say, oh, it would be a good idea to turn off and step back. I see people on Twitter all the time saying, I'm taking a break from Twitter. It's taking up my life. It's making me too anxious. It's making me too angry. It's making me too sad. I need to take a break from Twitter. And 3 hours later, they're tweeting again. I see this all the time. I'm like, whatever happened to your break from Twitter? But the pull is so great, which is, we're going to get to your conversation thing in a minute. The pull is so great that it's very hard to say no. And so having that mandated saying no, I find to be such an enormous bracha, I can't even tell you. Which gets me to my answer to your second question. I would like to say that I do not find that teenagers today either lack the ability or lack the desire to have conversation. I just had 15 high school students of mine, 15 11th graders at my house for Shabbos. You should see what my living room looks like. I just had 15 11th graders at my house for Shabbos. They want nothing more than to talk about anything and everything. Like all teenagers always have. They want to be listened to and engaged with seriously and taken seriously. Okay? But what? There is something about getting that buzz or that beep or that notification or that like that triggers something in our brain. There are actually neuroscientists who are looking at this, the extent to which it actually lights up the pleasure receptors in our brain in the same way that other pleasurable physical experiences do. And the people who design the cell phone technology and the social media technology very consciously do it in a way that continues to trigger that. So that it is actually very hard for us to resist the pull of what am I missing, what happened, what did someone say in response to what I said, did people like my pictures, or whatever it was. I don't see it as an inability to converse. I see it as an inability to overcome the pull towards that distraction. If people are shy or people are introverted, I think people always have been. If people need to learn how to make conversation on dates, I think people probably always needed to. But what I do think is the case is that when my phone is sitting there on the table or in my pocket, one of our school psychologists has told me, and again, I have not looked this up myself, but one of our school psychologists has told me that there is evidence to say that if your phone is out on the table, even if it's face down and you're not looking at it, your attention is more distracted because you're just thinking about who buzzed, who responded, what's going on, what's happening on social media that I'm not there. The anxiety around that is profound. I took a group of kids to Israel this year for whatever they were raising money for Shalva in Israel by running in the Jerusalem Marathon for Shalva. So I took a group of kids to Israel for 3 days. The second Shabbos was over, they all turned on their phones. I mean, that's what kids do anyway, the second Shabbos is over. I was like, I don't get what's going on. It's still Shabbos in America. All your friends are not on their phones. And then I realized there were 6 hours after Shabbos started for us in Israel that it was still weekday in America. And they missed out on 6 hours worth of social media interaction, 6 hours worth of, they have to see what they missed, they have to see what's going on. And so I don't think it's a lack of ability to converse, but it is without the enforced stricture of Shabbos, you must put the darn phone down. It is super duper hard. Again, not just for them, for us, for me. It's super duper hard to put the phone down and miss 12 hours of what's going on in the world out there. And so people don't. And how to train people to do that, that actually, we talk about we teach in school. I mean, we all first have to learn it, but then we actually have to teach that, right? When we did this Screenagers event, we brought somebody who was the head of educational technology at a private non-Jewish school in Riverdale called the Riverdale Country School as one of the panelists to speak to the parents. And he said to us when he spoke on the panel after the movie, he said, when I walked into this room, I put my phone on airplane mode. Right, on airplane mode, it's as though you're on an airplane. You turn off all the network connections, you can't get any notifications, you don't get any emails, you don't get any texts, nothing's happening on your phone for 2 hours. And he said to us, I actually don't believe in taking away kids' phones, Because then they don't learn how to manage that. You could agree with that philosophy or disagree. I'm not sure what I think about it. He said, you know, we have to teach kids how to manage it themselves, like put it on airplane mode when you're going into a... This is something we don't have down yet. We're not doing well yet. I told you, all teachers will say it's our biggest challenge. I walk around the school during classes, while classes are going on as an administrator, and I see all the kids who are supposedly going to the bathroom, but they're really standing outside the bathroom checking their phones. But we're doing it too, right? We had to make rules in school about administration meetings and faculty meetings about making them no tech spaces, because you ever been in a conversation with an adult who's supposedly talking to you while they scroll through their phone, or supposedly in a meeting while they're multitasking, which means they're not really paying attention to you because they're doing something else. So that, I think, is where a very real challenge still exists, where we don't have it down yet, we don't have it solved yet. We're still very much in the transitional phase into this world of new technology, and we got to figure it out. Yeah. So well, we've been up to our ears in this. Different schools do all kinds of different things. There are more middle schools that I know of that actually say you must park your phone at the beginning of the day and you can pick it up at the end of the day. When we went around to different communities from SAR, doing focus groups with parents in different communities, talking about technology in our kids, that was the topic. And the head of EdTech and I and two school psychologists went around to four different communities, I think, having these conversations. And we said to parents, well, what about locking up your kids' phones during the day? The parents said, please don't do that. The carpool plans changed. My kid is driving. He's picking up his brother. He's not picking up his brother. She has basketball practice after school. She doesn't have. I need to be able to access my kid during the day. So, which is interesting because, like, I don't know. What did we do when I was in high school? I mean, we sort of figured it out. I don't know. But once you're used to being able to be in contact with your kids, parents didn't want it. One teacher in my school bought like a little hanging thing with 24 pockets, and when kids walk into her class, they're numbered 1 to 24, you know what your number is. If you're 13, every single day when you walk into class, you drop your phone in slot 13, and you can take it when you leave. You can't use your phone in class rules, but the kids, you know, are all trying to figure out how to do it. So all of this is not yet resolved. What's the best approach? What works best? How do you do it? We're all still figuring this out because this is a very new world for all of us. The world of universal smartphones is relatively recent, right? And it easily is going to take us a while to adjust to this and figure it out. The world of Wi-Fi in schools, so the kids are all on networks all the time. And so we're all still figuring out, institutionally and individually, how to deal with this, and I don't think we know what's the best approach. On the one hand, it really resonates with me. I'll just tell you personally how I feel about it. I don't have data to back this up. Personally, how I feel, the idea that we have to teach kids to control their own use really resonates, but I think it takes a while to get there, and I think we need rules and restrictions to help them get in the habit of not checking their phone every 30 seconds while they develop that skill. I don't really want to say to a ninth grader, I'm not going to make a rule about phone use because I want you to develop the skill of self-control. I do want you to develop the skill of self-control. I'm not sure that 14 is the point at which you're ready to develop it, and I do want to have certain kinds of rules and limitations to help you get there. There are schools that take phones away. I don't know of many modern Orthodox high schools that do it. I know about middle schools that do it. Right, I'll say one last comment and then we'll conclude. My husband leaves his phone at home when he goes to Shacharis in the morning. Now, he can do it because he davens Shacharis here and he works here and he comes back home after Shacharis to get his phone. I understand why if you're going to davening on your way to work, it might not be viable. But that's a statement. I don't even want to have the distraction in my pocket. I don't want to have the temptation. I'll manage for an hour a day without my phone in my hand, right? Whatever rabbinical emergency comes up, it'll wait 45 minutes. The phone stays on the counter in the kitchen, plugged in, charging, while he goes off to shul. Again, these are choices not just that our kids make, but that we make. And if we know how powerfully distracting these things are and how hard it is for us as adults to resist them, our choices. To walk around with this device in my hand all the time is a choice. To walk around with it in my pocket all the time is a choice. It's a way I'm choosing to live in the world. It's what I'm choosing to model for my kids. My analogy to this for myself was that I realized that I was walking through the halls in schools like this, up and down the stairs in schools, looking at my phone. And I realized that was not okay. I'm not looking at kids. I'm not interacting with kids. I'm not smiling and saying hello to kids as I'm up and down the stairs. I'm looking at my phone. So I said for myself, I'm not walking through the hall. The phone has to be, if I need to look at my phone, to be wherever it is. I'm not walking through the hall on my phone. So we also have choices to make in how we interact and how we model and how we engage. It's really not just about the kids. And once we start thinking about that, when we start making those mindful, thoughtful, conscious decisions, we'll also model for teenagers a different way of engaging with this in the world. Thank you so much.